There has to be rope around here somewhere. Be right there. Charlie smiled at Carlton, hoping to reassure him, then joined the others, heading for the boxes in the corner beside the door. The first just held more paperwork, official forms with tiny print, but underneath was a box of tangled extension cords.
Hey, I found something,
Charlie said, but she was cut off by a banshee scream. Charlie was on her feet instantly, ready to run, but everyone else was still. Jessica was pointing to something in the corner, almost shaking. John was behind her, his eyes wide.
What is it?
Charlie demanded, and when they did not answer, she rushed over and looked down at the pile of empty costumes to where Jessica was pointing. It was hard to sort out what was what in the pile of mascots. She stared blankly at the jumble, seeing nothing but fur and eyes and beaks and paws, and then it resolved before her eyes. A dead man. He looked young, not much older than they were, and he looked familiar.
That's the cop, the one from the other night, John said, recovering his voice.
What?
Carlton said, snapping to attention. He came over to look.
That's Officer Dunn. I know him.
Your dad sent him to look for you, Charlie said quietly. What do we do?
Jessica said. She had been inching slowly backward, and now her foot bumped against Dave, and she jumped, stifling another scream. It pulled Charlie's eyes away from Dunn, and looking away was enough to recall her to their task.
There's nothing we can do, she said firmly.
Come on, we don't know how much time we have before he wakes up.
John and Jessica followed her across the room, Jessica catching up and keeping close to Charlie, as if afraid to get too far away from her again. Charlie grabbed a handful of cords and tossed it to John. It was a long and tedious process. They propped Dave up into a sitting position against the wall, but he kept sliding sideways until John took hold of his shoulders. John bent him forward as Charlie tied his hands behind his back. She finished and looked up to see John with a faint smile on his face.
Do my knots amuse you?
She said as lightly as she could manage. The feel of Dave's flesh, alive yet limp and heavier than it should have been, was disturbing. And as she let go of him, she could still feel the traces of his clammy skin on her palms. He shrugged.
All those times we played cops and robbers seem to have paid off.
I forgot about that, she laughed.
He nodded sagely.
And yet I still bear the scars of the rope burns you gave me,
John smiled.
And that was before I was even a Girl Scout, Charlie said. Stop complaining and pick up his feet. Let's hope my skills haven't atrophied.
She finished tying up Dave, pretending a confidence she did not really have. The cords were thick and stiff. They were hard to manipulate, and she was not sure how long they would hold. When she was as sure as she could be, she stepped back. John looked around for a moment as though searching for something, then slipped out through the door without a word. Carlton was on his knees, and he walked toward Dave without standing, a clunky, unsteady walk. He looked like he might tip over at any moment.
Wakey, wakey, sleepy head, he whispered.
We've got this, Carlton, thanks. You just relax.
Charlie rolled her eyes toward Jessica, then turned her attention back to Dave, slapping his face lightly, but he remained inert.
Hey, dirtbag, wake up.
She slapped him again.
Here, try this.
John reappeared with a can of water.
Water fountain,
was the only explanation he offered.
The can didn't hold much,
he added.
That's okay, Charlie said.
She took it from him and held it over Dave's head, letting the small streams of water dribbling from the holes in the tin fall on his face. She aimed for his mouth, and after a few moments, he spluttered, his eyes opening.
Oh, good, you're awake,
Charlie said, then dumped the rest of the water on his head. He said nothing,
but his eyes remained open in a stiff, unnatural stare. "So, Dave," she said, "how about you tell us what's going on?" His mouth opened slightly, but no words came out. After a moment, he became still again, so still that Charlie reluctantly pressed her fingers to his neck to check for a pulse.
"Is he alive?"
John said, creeped out by what seemed to be an on-again, off-again, animated corpse. He moved closer to the man, kneeling so their eyes were level, and looked at him gravely, searching for something. "His pulse is normal," Charlie reported. She pulled her hand back, more startled than if he'd been dead.
"Charlie, there's something different about him," John said urgently.
He reached out and grasped Dave's chin, turning his head back and forth. Dave did not resist. He just kept staring without expression, as if the world around him were not really there.
"What do you mean?" Charlie said, though she saw it too. It was as if the guard, the man they had met, had been stripped away, and what sat before them was nothing but a blank canvas.
John shook his head and released the guard's chin, wiping his hands on his pants. He stood and stepped back, putting a distance between them.
"I don't know," he said. "There's just something different."
"Why don't you tell us about the kids?"
Carlton was leaning back against the wall, emboldened but still not completely balanced.
"The kids you killed. You stuffed them into those suits out there."
Carlton motioned toward the stage outside.
"Carlton, shut up," John said angrily. "Everything you're saying is nonsense."
"No, it's true," Charlie whispered.
John gave her a searching look, then turned to the others, who had no more answers than Charlie. He looked back at Dave with an expression of renewed disgust. Seeing John's face, Charlie was suddenly struck with the weight of memory. Michael, who had been a cheerful, careless little boy, Michael who had drawn portraits of them all, passing them around with a solemn pride. Michael who had been killed, whose final moments must have been all pain and terror. Michael, who had been killed by the man before them. She looked to the others, and on each of their faces she saw the same single thought. This was the man who killed Michael. Without warning, John's arm shot out like lightning and struck Dave across the jaw with a loud crack. Dave slumped back, and John lunged and almost fell from the impact of the strike. John regained his posture and bounced a little on the balls of his feet, alert, waiting for a reaction or a chance to strike again. Dave's body moved upward, straightening, but the movement was too smooth. He seemed to make no effort, use no muscles, and exert no energy. Slowly, his posture corrected, unfolding to his slumped state, his mouth hanging open. Carlton stumbled forward.
"Take that, jackass!"
He swung his arm into the air and swayed on his feet. Jessica leaped forward just in time to catch him in her arms. Dave continued to stare, and it was only after a moment that Charlie considered that he might actually be staring at something. She turned, following his line of sight, then suddenly she recoiled. On the table along the wall sat a rabbit's head.
"That's it? You want that?"
Charlie stood and approached the mask.
"You need this?"
she added in a whisper. She picked it up carefully, the light catching the edges of the spring locks that filled the mascot's head. She picked it up and carried it almost ceremoniously to Dave, who tipped his head down in a barely noticeable fashion. Charlie placed it over his head, not being nearly as cautious as she had been with Carlton. When the mascot's head was fully resting on his shoulders, the large face raised itself until it was almost completely upright. Dave's eyes opened steadily, glassy and without emotion, like the robots on the stage outside. Lines of sweat began to trickle down from under the mask, a stain darkening the collar of his uniform shirt. My dad trusted you, Charlie said. She was on her knees now, looking intently at the rabbit's face. What did you do to him? Her voice broke.
I helped him create.
The voice came from inside the mask, but it was not Dave's, not the pitiful, sour tone they would have recognized. The voice of the rabbit was smooth and rich, almost musical. It was confident, somehow reassuring, a voice that might convince you of almost anything. Dave cocked his head to the side, and the mask shifted so that only one of his bulbous eyes could peer through the sockets.
We both wanted to love, he said in those melodious tones. Your father loved, and now I have loved.
You killed, Carlton said, then burst out with something that sounded like a laugh.
He seemed more lucid now, as if anger was focusing his mind. He shook loose of Jessica's hands on his arms and knelt down on the floor.
You're a sick bastard, Carlton sputtered. And you've created monsters. The kids you killed are still here. You've imprisoned them.
They are home with me.
Dave's voice was coarse, and the large mascot's head slid forward and tilted as he spoke.
Their happiest day.
How do we get out?
Charlie placed one hand on the mascot's head and pushed it back into position on Dave's shoulders. The fur felt wet and sticky, as though the costume itself were sweating.
There isn't a way out anymore. All that's left is family.
His round eye reappeared through one of the sockets, glimmering in the light. He locked eyes with Charlie for a moment, struggling to lean in closer.
Oh, he gasped. You're something beautiful, aren't you?
Charlie recoiled as if he had touched her. What's that supposed to mean? She took another step back, fighting a surge of revulsion.
Well then, you're trapped too, and you're not going to be hurting anyone else, John said in response to the veiled threat. I don't have to, Dave answered. When it gets dark, they will awaken. The children's spirits will rise. They will kill you. I'll just walk out in the morning, stepping over your corpses one by one.
He looked at each of them in turn, as if relishing the bloody scene.
They'll kill you too, Jessica said.
No, I am quite confident that I will survive.
Really? John said suddenly.
I'm pretty sure they're the spirits of the kids you killed,
he all but spat.
Why would they hurt us? It's you they're after. They don't remember, Dave said. They've forgotten. The dead do forget. All they know is that you are here, trying to take away their happiest day. You are intruders.
He lowered his voice to a hush.
You are grown-ups.
They looked at one another.
We're not,
Jessica began.
You're close enough, especially to a vengeful, confused, and frightened child. None of you will survive the night. And what makes you think they won't kill you?
John said again, and Dave's eyes took on something shining, almost beatific.
Because I am one of them, he said.
Chapter 12. They all stood staring at the man on the floor. Jessica took an involuntary step backward. Charlie was glued to the spot. She could not look away from him. Because I am one of them. As if he could tell what she was thinking, John stepped up beside her.
Charlie, he's insane,
he said quietly, and it was enough to break her away from that dreadful, ecstatic gaze. She turned to John.
We have to get out, she said.
He nodded, turned back to the group, and gestured to the walkie-talkie in his hand.
I'm going back to the control room, he said. These things are police radios. There has to be a way to get them to reach the outside. Maybe I can use the equipment in there to get a signal somehow.
I'll go with you, Charlie said instantly, but he shook his head.
You have to stay with them, he said, barely audible.
Charlie looked over at Jessica and Carlton. He was right. Carlton needed someone with him, and Jessica. Jessica was holding it together, but she couldn't be left alone in charge of the safety of both of them. Charlie nodded.
Be careful, she said.
He didn't answer. Instead, he tucked the walkie-talkie into his belt, gave her a wink, and left. Clay Burke was in his office, reviewing the week's case files. There was not much. Traffic violations, two petty thefts, and one confession to the murder of Abraham Lincoln. Clay shuffled through the papers and sighed. Shaking his head, he pulled open the bottom drawer of his desk and removed the file that had been plaguing him all morning. Freddy's. When he closed his eyes, he was there again. The cheerful family restaurant, its floor streaked with blood. After Michael disappeared, he had worked 14-hour days, sometimes sleeping in the station. Every time he came home, he went to look at Carlton, who was usually asleep. He wanted to grab his son and hold him close, never let him go. It could have been any of the children there that day. It was blind, dumb luck that the killer had spared his own. At the time, it was the first murder that the department had dealt with. It was a 16-person department, usually charged with small thefts and noise complaints, and to be handed a gruesome murder made all of them feel a little like kids whose toy guns had suddenly turned real. Clay opened the file, knowing what he would find. It was only a partial report. The rest of it was in a storage room in the basement. He scanned the familiar words, the bureaucratic language that tried but failed to obscure the point. There had been no justice done.
Sometimes the guilty get away with terrible things, but it is the price we pay.
He had said that to Charlie. He cringed a little now, realizing how that must have sounded, to her of all people. He picked up the phone, calling the front desk in a moment of urgency rather than walking the 20 feet to ask in person.
Has Dunn reported back from Freddy's?
He asked before the officer on the other end could speak.
No, sir, she said.
He hung up, not waiting for her to finish. Clay stared restlessly at the wall for a long moment, then grabbed his coffee cup and headed to the basement. He didn't have to search for the box of evidence from the Freddy's disappearances. He had been here before. There was no one around, and so instead of taking it upstairs to his office, Clay sat down on the concrete floor, spreading papers and photographs around him. There were interviews, witness statements, and reports from the on-scene officers, Clay included. He sifted through them aimlessly. He didn't know what he was looking for. There was nothing new here. There was nothing to find, really. They knew who did it. At first he had suspected Henry, just like so many others around town. It was a terrible thought, but it was a terrible crime. There was no solution that would not be shocking. He had not been the one to question Charlie's father, but he had read the transcript. The man had been almost incoherent, so shaken that he could not give straight answers. He sounded as if he were lying, and to most people, that was proof enough. But Clay had resisted, had delayed having him arrested, and sure enough, they came to William Afton, Henry's partner. Afton seemed like the normal one in the venture, the businessman. Henry was the artist. He always seemed to be off in another world, some part of his mind thinking about his mechanical creatures, even when he was holding a conversation about the weather or the kids' soccer games. There was something off about Henry, something almost shell-shocked. It seemed like a miracle that he could have produced a child as apparently normal as Charlie. Clay remembered when Henry had moved to town and begun construction of the new restaurant. Someone had told him that Henry had a kid who had been abducted several years prior, but he didn't know much else. He seemed like a nice enough guy, though he was obviously terribly alone, his grief visible even at a distance. Then Freddy Fazbear's opened, and the town came alive. That was also when Charlie appeared. Clay hadn't known Henry even had a daughter until that day. William Afton was the one who made Freddy's a business, as he had the previous restaurant. Afton was as robust and lively as Henry was withdrawn and shadowy. He was a hefty man who had the ruddy geniality of a financially shrewd Santa Claus. And he had killed the children. Clay knew it. The whole department knew it. He had been present for each abduction, and he had mysteriously and briefly vanished at the same time as each child went missing. A search of his house had found a room crammed with boxes of mechanical parts and a musty yellow rabbit suit, as well as stacks of journals full of raving paranoia, passages about Henry that ranged from wild jealousy to near worship. But there had been no evidence. There had been no bodies, and so there could be no charge. William Afton had left town, and there was nothing to stop him. They did not even know where he had gone. Clay picked up a picture from the pile. It had been taken, framed, from the wall of Henry's office at the restaurant. It was a picture of the two of them together, Henry and William, grinning into the camera in front of the newly opened Freddy Fazbear's. He stared at it. He had stared at it before. Henry's eyes did not quite match his smile. The expression looked forced, but then it always did. There was nothing unusual here, except that one of the men had turned out to be a killer. Suddenly, Clay felt a shock of recognition, something indistinct he could not quite catch. He closed his eyes, letting his mind wander like a dog off the lead. Go on, find it. There was something about William, something familiar, something recent. Clay's eyes snapped open. He shoved everything back into the evidence box, cramming it in messily, keeping out only the photograph. Clutching it, he took the stairs up two at a time, almost running by the time he got to the main floor of the station. He headed straight for a particular filing cabinet, ignoring the greetings of his startled officers. He tore open the drawer, pawing through it until... There it was. Employee background checks requested by businesses from the last 6 months. He pulled out the stack and flipped through it, looking for photos. In the third folder, he found it. He picked up the picture and held it up next to the one of Henry and William, turning so his body did not block the light. It's him. The background check application was labeled Dave Miller, but it was unmistakably William Afton. Afton had been fat and affable. The man in the picture was sallow and thin, his skin sagging and his expression unpleasant, as if he had forgotten how to smile. He looked like a poor facsimile of himself. Or maybe, Clay thought, he looked like he had dropped his disguise. Clay flipped the page back to see why the check had been requested, and his face drained white, his breathing stopping for a moment. Clay stood, grabbing his jacket in the same motion, then stopped. Slowly, he sat, letting the jacket fall from his fingers. He took the partial file back out of its drawer, and delicately he lifted one of the photos out. It had been taken in the aftermath, when the place was no more than a crime scene. He paused for a moment and closed his eyes. Then he looked again at the picture, willing himself to see it as if for the first time. There was a glimmer of light he had never noticed before. One of the animatronics on the stage, the bear, Freddy, was looking toward the cameraman, one of his eyes illuminated with a smear of light. Clay put the picture aside, moving to the next one. This one was from a different angle, but the side of the main stage was still in the frame. Chica's body was facing away from the camera, but her face was turned directly toward it, and another smear of light streaked across her left eye. Clay rubbed it with the tip of his finger, making sure it wasn't a defect in the paper. The next photo showed Bonnie in the darkness behind the chairs. A pinpoint of light, like a star, shone from one of his eyes as though reflecting a spotlight that wasn't there. What is this? Clay could feel his face flush. He realized he hadn't been breathing. He shuffled his hands on the desk like a conjurer, calling forth a picture to reveal itself. One did. The last picture had been taken in Pirate's Cove. Tables had been disturbed, he remembered. The scene was chaotic. The tables and chairs in disarray, clutter strewn through the halls. But unlike so many other times he had stared at this picture, he ignored the disorder and focused only on the stage. The curtain was pulled back slightly, a figure barely visible in the recesses behind it. One eye, presumably illuminated by the flash of a camera. Clay studied the rest of the pictures, looking for more reflections, but found none. There was no flash. Jason opened his eyes. His leg hurt. It was a steady, dull pain. He flexed it tentatively and found he could move easily. The injury could not be too bad. He was lying on something lumpy, and his whole body felt stiff, like he had been asleep on a pile of... He looked at what he was lying on, a pile of extension cords and wires. He sat up. It was dark, but he could dimly see what was around him. He bent over to examine his leg. His jeans were ripped where Foxy's claw had gouged him, and the gash in his leg was ugly, but it was not bleeding badly. The hook had mostly got hold of his jeans. Jason felt a little relief. Satisfied, he began to examine his surroundings. He was in a corner, and there was a heavy black curtain strung from one wall to the other, cutting the space off from the room outside. He crawled forward over the cables cautiously, careful to make no sound. He made his way to the edge of the curtain, where there was a tiny sliver of a gap between it and the wall. Jason took a moment to steel himself, then peeked out, conscious of his every movement. He was on the small stage in Pirate's Cove, behind the curtain. He could hear something moving out there, something large, but from his position he could see only an empty room. He pushed his head out a little farther, craning his neck to look. He couldn't tell where the sound was coming from, but with each second he grew bolder, readying himself to leap from the stage and run. A light was pulsing in the main dining room, illuminating the hall for brief seconds at a time with bright, dizzying carnival colors. It wasn't much, but it gave Jason a direction to run. He watched it intently until it was all he could see, and then it stopped. The room was dark, darker than it had been before. His eyes had adjusted to the light, and now he was nearly blind. The shuffling sound went on, and Jason pulled the curtain open farther. This time he moved too fast, and as the curtain was drawn, the metal rings that held it clinked together. The light above Pirate's Cove went on. Foxy was there, right in front of him, his face so close to Jason's that they could almost touch. Jason scrambled back through the curtain, pulling it closed again, trying to escape the small alcove, but there was nowhere to run. He crawled backward, staying against the wall, hoping that the curtain would somehow shield him from Foxy. At once, the curtain began to open, not by force, but as if a show were about to begin. Lights and color flashed in silent patterns, and the glittered front curtains rolled back in grand fashion to reveal the stage, with the beast standing patiently at its base. Foxy cocked his head to the side as if considering something, and then he began his approach. He climbed the stairs to the stage one by one, each step a whole series of disjointed movements, as if each piece of his metal body maneuvered itself individually. Jason watched, struck with horror, yet some small part of him was enthralled. It was like nothing he had ever seen. Foxy reached the stage and took two more large, deliberate steps until he was standing over Jason. Jason stared up at him, too afraid to move, frozen in place like a mouse beneath a diving falcon. His breath was shallow, his heart beat so fast his chest hurt. Foxy raised his hook again, and Jason threw himself down on the floor in a ball, protecting his head with his arms, waiting for the blow to come. It did not come. Jason did not move. He waited and waited, wondering if time had slowed down as he approached the moment of his death, his mind trying to give him refuge, making the last moments feel as long as possible. But not this long. He opened his eyes and turned his head a little, keeping his arms in front of his face. Foxy was still there, not moving. Despite himself, Jason met the creature's eyes. It was like looking into the sun. Foxy's burning gaze made Jason's eyes tear up, made him want to look away, but he could not. It was the animatronic who looked away. As Jason watched, peering through the afterburn that clouded his vision, Foxy turned to face his absent audience. His hook fell slowly to his side, his head tilted forward, and he went motionless. The sounds of whirring machinery and clicking parts came to a stop, and the curtains drew closed again.
"Ready?" Lamar said.
Marla nodded curtly. "I'm ready," she said. She threw open the door, fists clenched, and they climbed out, facing opposite directions, preparing for an assault. Marla was breathing heavily, her face furious. The darkness was thick, almost tangible, and she could barely make out what was around her. She could see Lamar, but if they drifted 3 feet apart, they would be lost to each other. The lights above them flickered, but only for a moment. The brief illumination ruined what little night vision they had, making the dark impenetrable.
"Anything on your side?" Marla whispered.
Lamar looked toward her voice, distressed.
"No. Anything on your side?"
"Light, please,"
Marla whispered. Lamar held up the flashlight as though aiming a weapon and turned it on. Above them, the lights sputtered. Jason could see their flashlight waving back and forth, filtering through the slightly transparent curtain. Oh no. The light fell on the animatronic, just for a moment, and there was a clicking noise. Jason looked up. Foxy was not moving. The light swept across him again, and again the mechanical sounds came, this time unmistakable, though he still did not move. Jason scooted forward, around Foxy's foot, and looked up at the animatronic's face as the light struck him again. Again, the clicking noise came. Something inside him was readying itself, but his eyes stayed dark. Jason crawled as far forward as he was willing to venture, trying not to cross into Foxy's line of sight. He made it to the edge of the curtain and reached his arm out to wave a warning.
"Jason!"
He heard his sister's voice, and then a quick shushing from what must have been Lamar. The flashlight swept up, trained on the stage, and Foxy's eyes lit up. His head swept toward the light with a predatory precision, and Jason, panicked, reached for the pile of cords and grabbed a cable. Foxy lifted a foot, and Jason threw the cord around it and yanked with all his strength. Foxy pitched forward, grabbing at the curtain with his hook. It caught, ensnaring him, and he ripped through the cloth with a vicious tearing noise, falling to the ground in a tangle of cloth and metal limbs. Jason scrambled past the struggling creature and ran toward the light. Marla reached for him, but he brushed her aside.
"Run!"
he panted, and the three of them took off down the hall. They turned a corner, and as one they stopped, Jason skidding against Lamar and grabbing him for support. At the end of the dark hall stood another figure, too large to be a person. The top hat was unmistakable. Freddy Fazbear. His eyes were illuminated, their piercing red glow consuming the space around him. They could hear the brittle notes of a song, mechanical and thin like a music box, coming from Freddy's direction. They stared, mesmerized. Then Jason found himself and pulled at Marla's arm.
"Come on,"
he hissed, and they followed him, running back the way they had come. When they reached Pirate's Cove, they slowed. Foxy had thrown off the curtain and was beginning to right himself. The three exchanged glances, then ran past him. Jason held his breath until they were through to the next doorway, invoking some old superstition. Lamar motioned to one of the party rooms, and they ducked inside. He switched off the flashlight, and they stood still for a moment, their eyes adjusting. The room had three long, cafeteria-style tables, each one still set for a party. Metal folding chairs were lined all up and down them, and each place was set with a party hat, a paper plate, and a plastic cup. By wordless agreement, each hid beneath a different table, leaving themselves as much space as possible. They crouched low, hoping to be lost behind the chair legs, and together they stared silently into the vacant hall and listened.
"Hello? Anyone?"
John repeated into the radio, but there was only static. He had managed to hook the walkie-talkie into the sound system, but getting a signal to the outside seemed impossible. Freddy's was sealed off from the world. He looked at the monitors again. On one screen he could see three figures crouched under tables. Marla, Lamar, and Jason, he thought. They found Jason, he realized with profound relief, letting go of a tension he had not known he felt. Everything on screen was lit with unnatural grays and whites.
These must be night vision cameras, he said to no one, squinting to see through the static.
He watched the blurry figures crawl and come to a stop beneath the long party tables, then movement from another screen caught his eye. There was a figure in the hallway, moving steadily toward the room they were in. John could not tell what it was, but the way it moved wasn't human. It stopped beside a doorway, and with a sudden jolt of realization, John looked again at the party room where his friends were hiding. He grabbed the walkie-talkie and flipped the speaker system on, jamming the volume control as high as it would go.
"Lamar," he said calmly, trying to sound commanding.
He heard the reverberation of his own voice through the walls of the control room.
"Lamar, don't move."
John's voice blared over the speaker, blurred with static but intelligible.
"Lamar, don't move."
Lamar, Marla, and Jason looked at one another across the distance between the tables. The room lit up with a burning red glow, and they watched, as still as they could be, as Freddy Fazbear entered the room. His movements were mechanical and graceless as he walked with deliberate steps to the middle of the room and stopped between two tables. Marla on one side, Jason on the other. Jason looked at his sister, and she put a finger to her lips. Jason hadn't realized that there were tears on his cheeks until now. He watched as Freddy surveyed the room. His head, with eyes like spotlights, whirred to one side, stopped with a click, and then turned to the other side. There was a long pause. The two padded feet were motionless, the legs like black trees in a forest. There was a sound of twisting fur and crinkling fabric, and the feet began to pivot. Freddy turned around and headed for the door, each step shaking the floor beneath him. As Freddy passed by, Jason shrank back instinctively, his foot hitting one of the metal chairs. It made a scraping sound. Jason's heart raced. Frantic, he looked across the space at Marla, who beckoned to him urgently. Freddy had stopped, but they could still hear the sound of fabric and fur scrunching and moving. Freddy began to bend down. His motions were slow, and in those precious few seconds, Jason pushed the two chairs in front of him apart, making a gap just wide enough for him to be able to crawl behind Freddy as soon as he had the chance. The light of Freddy's eyes came into view under the table, illuminating the space beside Jason, and he quickly but quietly crawled between the chairs to where Marla was hiding. Freddy stood again, training his eyes on the floor just as Jason pulled his foot out of sight. Freddy began to pivot toward the table they were under. Marla put a hand on Jason's arm, steadying him. There was another pause. Lamar, under the table opposite them, beckoned to Marla and Jason, urging them to his own table, farther away from Freddy. Marla shook her head, not wanting to risk making noise.
Maybe he's leaving, she told herself.
Jason was beginning to breathe normally again when it struck them. Freddy was ducking down again, this time silently. His eyes had gone dark, but as soon as they spotted him, his gaze lit up again, illuminating the room. Marla and Jason scrambled around the metal chairs as fast as they could without touching them. They crawled across the thin carpet between tables until they came across an opening in the chairs and crawled under the table beside Lamar. Marla and Lamar looked at each other, at a loss. Freddy was straightened up again and beginning to circle around to the third table.
We have to run for the door, Marla whispered.
Lamar nodded, then motioned for them to follow his lead. He watched, waiting until Freddy was bending down once again, and then gestured to the middle table. They caught their breath, trying not to gasp, and Lamar looked toward the door.
Could they make it?
Marla put a hand on Jason's shoulder, and he started to shrug her off, but she was gripping him tightly, her fingers digging into him. He moved to brush her away, then looked at her. She was terrified, even more than he was. He let her hold on to him while keeping his eyes on Freddy, waiting for their next opening. It didn't come. As they waited, poised for flight, Freddy turned away, his deliberate steps taking him to the doorway. The room went dark, and Jason's heart skipped before he understood what had happened. The lights were gone because Freddy was gone.
Marla,
he whispered, his voice little more than a breath of air.
He's gone.
Marla looked at him and nodded, but she did not let go of his shoulder.
Are you okay?
She asked in the same almost soundless way. He nodded, then pointed to his leg and shrugged theatrically. She smiled at him and took her hand from his shoulder to muss his hair. Suddenly, Lamar was tapping Marla's arm. He pointed to his ear, and she gave him a puzzled look. Jason stiffened, realizing what it was, and in a second Marla did too. There was music in the room, a tinny, labored sound like a music box, the gaps between the notes just a little too long. The room lit up again, a drowning red, and before they could move, the table was wrenched away. Freddy stood over them. He shoved the table aside, almost hurling it. They screamed, not a scream for help, but the last, futile act of defiance. Jason clung to his sister, and she pulled his head down against her, shielding his eyes so he would not have to see. Suddenly, Freddy stumbled off balance and lurched to the side. He tried to right himself, but another jolt from behind sent him flying forward, falling face first into the tables. Marla, Lamar, and Jason looked up to see Charlie and John, their faces flushed with effort.
Come on, Charlie said. Let's go.
Dave shrugged out of his bonds quickly. The knots were sturdy, but the cords had too much give. A few twists and turns, and he was free. He crawled to the door on hands and knees and held his ear to the crack, careful not to jostle the door and give himself away. The loudspeaker blared, and then the sound he had been waiting for. Footsteps, running away. He waited just until the sound faded, then got purposefully to his feet.
Where are we going?
Marla panted as they raced back toward the main dining room.
The office, Charlie called. It's got a real door. We can barricade ourselves in.
She glanced at John, who nodded shortly. What they would do once they were barricaded inside was another question, but they could worry about that once they were safe. They ran through the dining room. Charlie glanced at the stage, blurred in passing, but she saw what she knew she would. It was empty. They reached the narrow hall that led to the office, and Charlie's heart lifted when she saw the door, light shining from its small window like a beacon.
Wait. Light?
She slowed her pace. They were 10 feet from the door. She lifted a hand, signaling the others to stop, and they approached the door slowly. Steeling herself, Charlie grabbed the knob and turned. It was locked. She looked helplessly at the others.
"Someone's in there,"
Jason whispered, moving closer to Marla.
"There's no one else here,"
Marla said softly, but it sounded like a question. Charlie was about to try the door again, but stopped herself.
"Don't draw their attention."
"He got loose,"
Jessica said, her voice hoarse, and Charlie felt a chill.
"She's right."
She didn't say it.
"We have to go back," she said.
Without waiting for a response, she turned, pushing between Lamar and John to take the lead. She took two steps forward, then stopped dead as she heard the others gasp. It was Chica, her eyes like burning orange headlights. She stood at the other end of the short hall, blocking their only way out. Her body filled the space. They could not even try to run past her. Charlie glanced behind her, even though she knew there was no other way out. Before she could react, John was running at the animatronic. He had no weapons, but he hurtled himself toward the thing and leaped up, trying to grab hold of her neck. He caught it briefly, struggling to hold on as Chica thrashed her head back and forth. Chica bent forward and swung to the side, slamming John into the wall, and John let go, crumpling to the floor. The cupcake on Chica's platter snapped its mouth as if laughing, its eyes rolling in their tiny sockets.
"John!"
Charlie cried as she thrust the flashlight back for someone else to take. She felt its weight leave her hands, but she didn't look back to see who took it. She looked up. There was an electrical cord dangling above their heads. Parts of the rubber had worn away, exposing stretches of bare wire. Chica was slowly advancing. Charlie jumped up, but she could not get high enough to reach it. She looked to either side.
"Is it narrow enough?"
She glanced at Chica. She was moving slowly, with measured steps. They were trapped, and she did not need to hurry. Charlie planted one foot against the wall, then stretched her leg across the narrow hallway and did the same on the other side, bracing between the walls to climb. She inched upward, her legs shaking with the effort. She looked up, struggling to retain her balance as she reached for the cord. Careful to touch only the rubber, she closed her fingers around it and dropped to the ground. Chica lunged forward, her arms extended and her teeth contorted in a mechanical smile. Charlie sprang up, the electrical cord brandished in front of her, and she shoved it into the space between Chica's head and her torso. Chica jerked backwards, sparks flying, and for a horrible moment Charlie could not move. Her hand throbbed with the electric current, and she was caught there, unable to make her hand let go of the wire. She stared down at it, willing her fingers to open.
"Is this how I die?"
Lamar grabbed her and pulled her away, and she looked up at him wide-eyed. The others were already running. Chica was deactivated, or so it appeared, slumped forward, her eyes dark. Lamar gave her arm a tug, and they took off after the others. With a pleased smile, Dave watched the confrontation through the window in the office door.
"Just a matter of time now," he thought. The girl had been clever, climbing the walls like that, but she had almost killed herself. They could not last much longer. All he had to do was wait. Suddenly, the room was lit with an ethereal blue. He froze, then slowly turned. Bonnie. The animatronic towered over him, close enough to touch. Dave fell back against the door and screamed.
There was a scream from the direction of the office. The group paused for a minute and looked nervously at one another.
"It doesn't matter," Charlie said. "Come on."
She took a quick look back at Chica, who was still slumped forward, inert. Charlie led them into the main dining room. As they emerged, there was a sudden movement. Foxy was there. He leaped onto a table in front of them, looking among them until his silver eyes lit on Jason. He crouched as if he were about to jump on the boy, and Charlie grabbed a napkin dispenser and threw it as hard as she could. It struck Foxy's head, glancing off with little effect, but it was enough to get his attention. He turned to her and pounced. Charlie was already running, racing to lure him away from the others. Then what? She thought as she ran furiously out of the dining room and down the hall. The arcade. It was dark. There were things to hide behind. She kept running full out until she reached the door, then turned so fast she almost fell, hoping to give Foxy a moment's disorientation. She looked around frantically. There was a row of arcade machines at the back of the room, set out just a little from the wall. She heard footsteps behind her and dove for it. The space was so tight she could barely squeeze herself into it. Her sides were pressed between the consoles and the wall, and there were thick, coiled wires beneath her feet. She took a step back, moving deeper into the crawl space, but her foot slipped on a cable, and she barely kept from falling. Movement in the room caught her eye, and she saw a flash of silver light. "He sees me." Charlie dropped to her hands and knees. She crawled backward, scooting inch by inch. Her foot caught on a cable and she stopped to free it, twisting into an impossible position to quietly dislodge it. She moved back farther, and then her foot bumped against another wall, and she stopped. She was closed in on three sides. It almost felt safe. She closed her eyes for a moment. "Nothing here is safe." There was an awful sound, a clash of metal hitting metal, and the console at the far end of the row rocked on its foundation, banging back against the wall. Foxy leaned over it, and now Charlie could see him as he smashed the display, spilling shards of plastic onto the floor. His hook caught on something inside the machine, and he yanked it out again, trailing bits of wire. He moved on to the next game, smashing the screen and throwing the console against the wall with a casual brutality. Charlie felt the impact of it echoing through the wall as he moved closer. "I have to get out. I have to." But there was no way out. Now that she was sitting in one place, she realized that her arm was stiff with pain, and only now did she look at it. The bandage was soaked through with blood. The wall beside her was streaked with a line of it where her arm had pressed. She wanted to cry suddenly. Her whole body ached. The wound in her arm, the constant tension of the last day or so, who could tell how long it had been, was draining her, taking all she had. The next console crashed against the wall, and Charlie flinched. It was only two away. He was almost to her. She could hear his gears working, humming, grinding, and sometimes screeching. She closed her eyes, but she could still see him, his matted fur, the metal bones showing through, the searing silver eyes. The console beside her was wrenched away and tumbled to the ground like it weighed nothing at all. The cords beneath Charlie's hands and knees jerked forward with it, and she slipped, grabbing at nothing, trying to regain her balance. She caught herself and looked up just in time to see the downward swing of a hook. She moved faster than she could think. She hurled herself at the final console with all her strength, and it balanced precariously, then fell, knocking Foxy to the ground and trapping him. Charlie started to run, but its hook shot out and snared her leg, cutting into her. She screamed, falling to the ground. She kicked at him with her other foot, but his hook was stuck deep in her leg. Every time he jerked back, she felt the impact. She kicked him in the face, and his hook tore free, slicing open her leg. She screamed again, instinctively grabbing the wound, and then Foxy was on top of her, snapping his jaws and clawing her as he tried to free his legs from under the console. She fought back, struggling to get away. His hook slashed at her again and again as she tried to block the blows, screaming for help. Suddenly, John was there. He stood over Foxy and stomped down hard on the creature's neck, holding his foot there. Foxy flailed but could not reach him.
"Charlie, get up," he called.
Charlie just stared at him for a second, too shaken to register the question. He stamped his foot on Foxy's neck repeatedly, and then in one quick movement, he grabbed Charlie's hand, heaved her up, and started to run, pulling her along behind him. They made it to the main dining room, where the rest of the group was huddled in the middle of the room. Relieved, Charlie rushed to join them. She could tell she was limping, but she did not feel any pain, which, she realized somewhere dimly in the back of her mind, was not good. When they got to the others, her heart sank. Their faces were grim. Lamar was holding the flashlight out in front of him, but it rattled in his trembling grip. Marla gestured quickly to the entrances. Freddie stood in the hall to the storage room, while Bonnie now blocked the hallway to the office. Chica, reanimated, stood on the stage, looming over them. Charlie glanced back the way they had come. Foxy was approaching. He had freed himself. He stopped in the doorway as if waiting for a signal. There was no escape. Suddenly acutely aware of everything around her, Charlie noticed the sound of a music box, as if she had, unconsciously, been hearing it all along. She took a deep breath. The moment seemed to go on forever. It had come to this. They were trapped. They waited. Now, perhaps for the animatronics, there was no hurry. Charlie cast her eyes around futilely for a weapon, but there were only party hats and paper plates. As one, the animatronics started their approach. Charlie grabbed the back of a metal folding chair, not sure how she could even use it. The animals were moving faster now, coming in unison, as if this battle were a choreographed dance. Marla took Jason's hand and whispered something in his ear. Whatever it was, he shook his head, set his jaw, and balled his hands into fists. Lamar glanced at him for a moment but said nothing. Jessica had her hands stiffly at her sides, and she was murmuring something to herself inaudibly. The animals were almost on top of them. Freddy's trundling walk was predatory, and the music box notes were coming from Freddy's direction. From inside Freddy, she now realized. Chica leaped from the stage and took small, bouncing steps toward them, as if excited but holding herself back. Bonnie's big, paw-like feet slapped the ground like a challenge, and Foxy slunk forth with a malevolent grace, his eyes fixed on Charlie as if she were the only thing he saw. She gazed into his silver eyes. They filled her vision, crowding out everything else until the world was silver. The world was Foxy's eyes, and there was nothing left of her. John squeezed her hand. It broke the spell. She looked at him, her vision still cloudy.
"Charlie," he said haltingly.
"Charlotte."
"Shh," she said.
"Later."
He nodded, accepting the lie that there would be a later. Foxy crouched down again, and Charlie let go of John, her heart pounding as she braced for it. Foxy's joints shifted in their sockets as he prepared to spring. Then he stopped. Charlie waited. There were no screams from behind her, no sounds of fighting. Even the music box was silent. Foxy was motionless, though his eyes still glowed. Charlie looked around, and then she saw. It was Freddy. Not the one they all knew. Not the one who stood less than a foot away from Marla, his mouth open as if poised to bite. It was the other one, the one she remembered, the yellow Freddy from the diner, the costume her father used to wear. It was looking at them, staring from the corner, and now she heard something. It was indistinct, just whispers in her head, a gentle susurrus, blowing through her conscious mind without taking hold. She looked at the others and knew they heard it too. It was indecipherable, but the meaning was unmistakable. Carlton was the one to say it.
"Michael?"
The sounds they heard grew warm, an unspoken confirmation, and together they approached the golden bear. Marla brushed past brown Freddy as if he were not there, and Charlie turned her back to Foxy, unafraid. There was only one thought in her mind.
Michael, it's you.
They were almost